when Ann spoke to the Poor People's World Summit to End Poverty that's coming up in New York City, November the 15th through the 18th after the elections. The four things that, you know, we have, like, the first day is personal experiences. Second is, like, strategy and tactics. And third is, like, resistant. And then, like, the fourth is how we're going to stay in constant communication to try to build, like, this large worldwide network. At this Poor People's World Summit, we're planning to have people from every region from around the world. And we're, you know, we're hoping we get at least 1,000 delegates that represent organization and people where we can sit down and have, like, the different discussions on all those four things that I just, like, the personal experience and stuff like that, and, you know, the strategies and tactics. How can we resist, like, that's coming up, the welfare reform, you know, the time limit, and also how we can build this large network that crosses borders just like the world trade ministers do, you know, and IMF and World Bank, you know.
Like, up here we have it's our human rights report. It's reports of different members of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. When Galen was talking about the New Freedom Bus and the different groups around the country that we've hooked up with as members of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, what's important to remember is that it's not Kensington Welfare Rights Unions in different cities, but rather, like, some of them take the form of, you know, downsized steel workers in Lorain, Ohio, and migrant farm workers in Florida, and, you know, public housing tenants in Chicago, and, you know, just various different groups that have all decided to use the framework of economic human rights. So what's important to remember is that in each particular area, it's going to be something different that people are interested in organizing around, whether it's, like, environmental pollution, or, you know, lack of affordable housing, you know, lack of access to education. It's going to be different for everyone, the community that's going to decide what they're going to organize around.
This is a community where there's not all that much unemployment, but there's an awful lot of very low-wage employment. And I think one reason why it may be hard to get movements going is so many people are working 60 or 80 hours a week. They're working two jobs. And even the people who are a little better off often are employed in some slightly funky, marginal way, can't get vacation, what have you.
I think that's the same thing that we're facing too. I mean, even with welfare reform and having our members having to go back to work for a certain amount of hours a week, or being, you know, cut off welfare and having to get a full-time job. I mean, we have women who are traveling, like, 2 hours, you know, each way to work in New Jersey from, you know, Philadelphia. And they still align themselves with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, which is why we're doing this retrenchment thing. Like, we need to find a way to, like, meet people where they're at. You know, if you're working 60 hours a week, then your level of commitment might be talking to people in your workplace, you know, or, you know, talking to people on your block instead of coming into our office every day and stuff like that.
Or at your church, or any type of community function that you might attend. That's our main thing. We're trying to, you know, like, you see the shirts that they have on Disappearing in America, Hiding the Poor, and we're seeing that they're doing that consciously. That's why it says Disappeared in America, because we see that it's a conscious, you know, it's a conscious effort to make sure that people disappear from, by saying the welfare rolls are down. You know, moving, like, all the homeless people from out of the downtown center city areas to out in other different surrounding counties, and we're saying that they're doing that consciously, and we're trying to say that, you know, we're not going to disappear. We're going to stand here and fight so that everyone has a right to their basic necessities, and until that we bring about a change where the government is going to be accountable for each and every individual, you know what I mean, in this country, you know, we're still going to have a problem where this extreme polarization that people are going to be able to do through capitalism. And I'm also an affiliate of the Labor Party.
What kind of resistance have you had from the establishment?
Well, on every level possible. Yeah, well, I can describe one of the major things that we was just trying to do right with the the March for Economic Human Rights in Philadelphia down Broad Street. One, we tried months and months and we couldn't get a permit, the march to talk about economic human rights. Not only did we not get a permit, we started getting different types of attacks and surveillance to try to preempt us from even doing the march, from the raiding of where we was making our signs and puppets and stuff like that for the march, with the LNI closing down where they was making the puppets at, to the DHS scare where they tried to talk about that they was getting a thousand new beds ready for just in case someone participating in the Republican National Convention protest would get arrested, like their kids could go get DHS would have a place for them. I don't know if people know or not, but DHS, the Department of Human Service, is more frightening to poor families than the police. Like the police you see every day, DHS is something that comes to take your kids away. That's how they look at it, and that's more frightening than the police. And also we had, like I said, the constant surveillance of, we had a Winnebago, a police Winnebago parked out in front of our office for like 4 months prior to the Republican National Convention. Also, right after the shooting of Thomas Jones? Right after the shooting of Thomas Jones, who was a carjacker that got beat down by the police and got shot like several times. After that, that was probably like, what was that? It was about 5 weeks before the Republican National Convention. Every week, the deputy commissioner from the police department would come in like every other day, twice a week, three times a week. Also bring in the captain at Civil Affairs, which is like the intelligence gathering agency for like on a local city level, who started just coming in our office constantly trying to figure out how they was going to preempt us or stop us from doing this march. Also with lawyers that when we was unable to get our permit, no lawyer in the city stood up to try to take this to federal court. The other two marches that was denied permits, the ad hoc community march, which was the healthcare rally, and the Unity 2000 march, which happened on the 29th and the 30th. Neither one of those organizations and groups was granted a permit at first, but they was taken right into federal court by the ACLU, and they was in turn granted a permit. But none of the other lawyers or anybody else stepped up when we was denied our permit.
What were the grounds that they denied you a permit?
Traffic.
Excuse me?
Traffic, man. That was the lame excuse. You know, essentially, like, they was like saying that was going to be the main corridor, you know, a doorway to bring in representatives from the Republican delegates downtown, hotels and stuff like that, to the First Union Center down Broad Street in South Philly, and which was, you know, an outright lie. Because they had all those vans, and a lot of them didn't want to travel where people knew exactly where they were, because it was not just us protesting in Philadelphia. It was a number of other different organizations and groups out there protesting also in Philadelphia.
So they leave the interpretation open that if you'd chosen a different street, you might have gotten the permit.
No, they try to hit us with the public, the transportation. Like, they try to hit us with a walk around City Hall, walk the Love Park, get on Broad Street, you know, the subway line, and take the subway line out. You know, like, we're talking tens of thousands of people. They talking less. They get on the subway line, take it out. You know what I mean? To this spot that they had picked that was pretty much
called the protest pit.
Yeah, no, they didn't even want us to go to the protest pit, because from the gate we denied that we would go there, that pit. But they took and had us like this spot that was like, they said, oh, this is kind of community friendly. You know what I mean? Y'all can go right here. It was like a mile and a half away from the First Union Center, you know, and this is the spot that they wanted us to all do set the transportation to this spot. Then once we got public transportation there, we could have a rally and stuff like that, and then people should disperse. You know, and that was taking us, you know, what our main focus was that day is to make sure the poor don't disappear in America, and that we could talk about some of the basic necessities of life. And with 15,000 reporters in town, we wasn't going to do that on the sneak tip. We wasn't going to sneak around and talk about economic human rights. With the police coming into our office every day, telling us that they was going to arrest us, they had the buses and the vans waiting for us as soon as we step off the sidewalk. You know, we thought, you know, we kept it on the inside to like a lot of people, but we was like, yeah, they was like, how far is it to the First Community Center?
Don't
even worry about it, man. We're going to get arrested. We're not even going to get that far. And so all the media was under that same assumption, too, that it's not even going to get that far. So I want my shots. I want my pictures. I want the kids. I want the people from ADEPT.
But the police said that they were going to arrest people as soon as they stepped off the curb.
Yes.
And what happened was I had told her there was a group of like handicapped people in wheelchairs that let it off. And they weren't about it. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's the group ADEPT. ADEPT and children led the march where the police in turn, you know what I mean, had to help us push the reporters back and the police along with members of the security from the Kids of Welfare Ice Union here linked arms and push reporters back out of the way for about the first three blocks to get the march rolling. It was amazing to me because people say we had like everybody, like all the friends from like longtime lawyers that been involved, you know what I mean, with the Kids of Welfare Rights Union since like, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. We had different other lawyers that have represented our director over like 60 some times. We had everybody from other different agencies all the way around the board telling us, oh, they're not going to let you march down Broad Street. And what we're trying to tell people that with the mass of the people, it don't take money. You know, I'm not going to lie. It do take money to organize. I'm not even going to lie. We wouldn't be here today if it wasn't. But we see that what's much more powerful than this money is the mass of people. When you walk down the street after the city has just tarnished its image, like the city of Philadelphia, they had the move, the bombing, you know what I mean, the move. They had like the police, couple of police shootings with the, they had like two police shootings prior to the Republican National Convention. One was Thomas Jones, the carjacking that they alleged that he had a gun and he didn't have no gun, you know what I mean, that was later found out, to the homeless man at 30th Street Station shot by Amtrak police officer. The guy was waving a chair over his head and they just shot him cold blood. And so Philadelphia had like a little image right then that, you know, around the country that it was all in the New York Times, on CNN, C-SPAN, all around the country. And some, you know, it even hit overseas because, you know, different people said that they, you know, they seen it over while they was in Ireland and stuff in the paper. Philadelphia cops wasn't, you know what I mean, they was like some hard knocks that was didn't care about justice or whatever, and that was just going to do whatever they wanted to do. You know, the city had to kind of like, we see that if it was maybe 50 people trying to march down Broad Street, they probably would have shut it down. With 15,000, like 10 to 15,000 people, you know, they didn't let us do anything, you know. They tried to talk about it, Timoney and all different people talked about it in the paper, and they even tried to like go more into what the media perception, you know, through the paper, trying to make people who didn't participate in the march or people that didn't know too much about to think that the Kinston Welfare Rights Union and the police department was in bed together, because they had a little cartoon, I kid you not, the police commissioner, the director of our organization, in a bed. They had the police commissioner handcuffed to the bed with our director sitting on the end of the bed. And, you know, just trying to like do this perception where like we was actually working together with the police and the police was working with us to try to make this march happen. And we know if we would have showed just 50, 60 people, the police would have smacked up, locked up, and took us all away real quick. So you can let 50 people walk down Broad Street, but you can't let 15,000 people walk down. 15,000 people are gonna walk down Broad Street. That's what happened. So they could say it like they let us and stuff like that, but we seen, you know who had the upper hand.
So you're basically suggesting you really don't need a permit, you don't need to parade to state power when you have the mantle?
We march for an entire month through 5 states and a district, because Washington, D.C. is a district. We marched through those 5 states in that district without absolutely one permit. We had like a few arrests along the route, like the crossing of one bridge where I think you can still see it on our website, the crossing of this bridge in Harris de Grace, Maryland, where they said no one never walked across this bridge, and we tried to walk across this bridge and some of our members and stuff like that was arrested. And then like another place where they wouldn't allow us to walk in the streets and a couple of people got arrested. I think one person, Sherry, got arrested. Our director got arrested. And the rest of the time, with no permit whatsoever, we march through a district in five states.
I was going to ask you what the structure of the organization is like.
Our organization is governed by a war council. And the reason why we call it a war council, because we see that right now we are in a wartime situation. Even though, just like in Vietnam, they didn't declare war, but it was a war. Right now, it's a war against the poor, even though it's not being declared. And our war council is the governing body, and I think it's a board of about 14 members. Two of the 14 might not have been homeless. The other 14 are definitely... some are still currently homeless and are formerly homeless. And so that's the governing body of the organization, where all the decision making go on, like the overall policy of, and the rest of it is done through this committee system. We have committees from you name it, we have a committee on it. That's where the decision making process for TAS campaigns, all that stuff is made. Our two major committees is our organizing committee and our educational committee. I think we try our best to be very creative and try to, I just think through our organization and the way we have networked with people throughout, not just Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, but this network that we have built nationally and international. And I see people that are some of these large corporations and a lot of these policymakers and stuff like that see that we're something that you have to reckon with. You know, you're not going to be able to talk about welfare reform and don't think the Kids in the Welfare Rights Union is not going to be around.
One of my thoughts is I've been thinking about Bob and George speaking about, well, okay, what do we do here? You know, how do we take the inspiration and the gift of your dedication to this issue, to this work, and bring it home. One is to really feel the inspiration here, and to look at each other for inspiration. I see a room full of tremendously dedicated activists with the compassion in this room is just, you know, like the walls are bulging. And that, so you were just talking about this network, you know, that coalition building and networking, I think, is really important for us. I know personally I get really overwhelmed very easily because everything feels so compelling. Vortex resistance, welfare rights, militarism, food, and military-industrial complex, you know. Poor people. And when there's an issue, you know, what can labor and Catholic Worker and the Food Network and Catholic Charities, what little piece can we contribute to the issue of welfare rights? I'm not sure what we would do with that, but at every time we come together like this, we should start building those lists of names of people and to be able to call on each other when issues come up. And I think the Sharks, for instance, have begun to do some good work that way in coalition building. Maybe somebody from there could.
Just want to say that the Sharks, she's talking about, we got started around E16, which was the big IMF World Bank protest in D.C., and like 100 people from here went down there, so we're really trying to. The Sharks is also the Ithaca Coalition for Global Justice. It's kind of our nickname, kind of a funner nickname than the Ithaca Coalition for Global Justice. I'm going to pass around a list. If people are interested in signing this, and I'm calling it a welfare rights potential interest list.
Yeah.
And feel free to sign up if you want. Put your phone and email down. How do we make the jump? Some of us are actually in this room choosing to live lives of voluntary poverty, but that's almost different than it kind of hit me. You know. And you know, how do we get to the point of like really, you know, inspire, you know, being. You know, you got this committee of two people who don't have to be, aren't affected by it in the same way. Like, how do we really join with people like this? You know, who are more affected by the issue? We had more time to think about it. Now, there's no one right answer, I know, but I'm just...
Having just been through the system and being rejected, I would advise each one of us in this room to go to a couple visits with a buddy that happens to be on welfare and just see what is going on in these buildings and who gets turned down and what hoops they have to jump through and how they're treated and who they can turn to. I know there's a lot of advocacy like Catholic Charities that helps people through. However, as I was waiting in the reception room, three guys came in and they said, well, you know, there aren't any open appointments until the 31st. And I know they're probably hard up right now. So I would just say, everyone learn the system from inside.
My executive director, George, might speak to that. I mean, we have, it's like, especially an organization like this, which is really trying to do the right thing, it's like pulling teeth to get money from the government to help serve people's needs. I mean, Samaritan Center, which is directly meeting people's needs on an emergency basis, what's the funding a year for that? $20,000?
Well, from the we have not received any public money for the first 3 years. We started Samaritan Center in 1997 in Tompkins County, and we have not received any public money for that. Our goal is to try to change that beginning with 2001. I've been spending this entire year communicating to the Board of Reps that there is an appropriate role for local governments to put resources into creating a safety net for those people who are at the point where they're ready to fall off the cliff. But what we need to make sure we do is make sure that people move further and further back from that cliff and do both of those things at the same time, which is what Catholic Charities is really committed to doing. Because one without the other doesn't work.
Definitely. Yes.
I'm really ashamed to admit this, but I know that when the last fixing welfare as we know it laws were passed.
What I call welfare deform or welfare repeal, not welfare reform. It'll vary from state to state. We all talk about this 5-year time frame. It's important to know that the end of that 5 years is December 31st, 2001. In New York State, our Constitution has a theoretical or written safety guard in it, and people are trying to figure out what that will mean once the federal welfare repeal goes into effect, and then state by state, different things happen. And I think that something is going to start to happen. Watch the Assembly and the Senate in the New York State government, something is going to happen before December 31st. The question is, what is going to happen before that? And how we have to keep talking about the fact that even with misguided, well-intentioned people who support a concept of welfare reform that we're living through right now, we need them to understand that that was a means to an end. The end is ending poverty. It's not reducing welfare rolls. So we need to evaluate it. And Ithaca, Tompkins County, is part of a national effort from the Children's Defense Fund, collecting data to look at the effects of welfare repeal. And how that gets reported and what information is talked about are huge questions, and it's very right to ask the questions you're asking, but it's important to know that it'll vary from state to state.
My question on that matter is, what are they gonna do about the people that have left town? Is that included?
Your shirt tells you exactly what they're gonna do.
Are you asking whether they can track
to live in America, you cannot go around racism and like the all the isms, the genderism, the homophobia, all that. You can't get at me. To live in America, you can't get at me. Get around that. And the way we've been dealing with that is that, you know, we've been educating people around, you know what I mean, this race issue, because a lot of people have under the conception that, you know, that's because you're black or you're Hispanic or you're an immigrant or something, you're going to be poor. And I know that the people that I've been linking up with and organizing with them, some of them, what I have in common with people, they've been multiracial. They've been from all different parts of the rainbow that I've been linking up with people. But I also know that, you know, it's a lot of people that are African America that don't have a damn thing in common with me. We're seeing that, you know, the issues of racism, it's one of the branches and stems from the root causes. That's one of the tools that's been used to keep people divided from being able to bring about this unity of the people to make sure that everyone had their basic necessities met, you know, that everyone's together on a level where we don't start like taxing, you know, oxygen and like fresh air and stuff. Like, okay, like you come outside and you gotta pay fees and stuff. Like all that stuff, we're trying to stop and make sure none of that happens, making it go right back to like basic stuff, like, you know, like food, like water, you know what I mean? All that stuff is needed for people to have a life, you know what I mean? To have like liberty and to pursue happiness. And there again, that's what our country is built on. And the issue of race, you know, comes up all the time, you know what I mean? But when you live in Kensington is a good model for the whole United States in a sense, because Kensington is very multiracial. It's poor whites, you know what I mean? It's poor black, it's poor Hispanics, it's immigrants, you know what I mean? It's people from all walks, from all ethnic background that live right there in Kensington that are all going through the same struggles and problems with living paycheck to paycheck, trying to make sure that they can keep their utilities on, to make sure that we sit and we debate whether we eat this week and the lights go off, or do we pay the gas this week and boom, the water goes off, or do I use my money for transportation to go back and forth to work, and you know, we eat oodles and noodles all week. These are the struggles that people from different gender, different races, different sexual preference are all going through, not just in Kensington, but all around the country. And we're saying that the racism and the homophobias and all that stuff, and that's been like branches away from the roots cause of the issue that keep people divided from bringing about a change. Through slavery and racism in this country, it was a way to control the masses of the people, the whites, you know, it's majority whites in this country. And through slavery and racism, that was a way of being able to control the masses of the whites. You wouldn't see a need for everyone to have food, clothing, and houses and stuff like that. During slavery, you know, blacks was looked at as three-fifths of a man, you know, and that was through, you know, like changing, making people's perception see, like, you know, that's something different from me. That's not, you know, I'm human, you know, or, you know, that's another type of human or whatever. So that didn't give people the connection where they wanted to link up and make sure that, you know, that everybody had food, clothing, and house and stuff like that. So it was a way that, you know, it kept the masses of the people controlled, because when like all along Appalachia, when that all got developed and stuff like that, you know, all the other people, you know what I mean, they didn't even think twice to say that everyone have a right to food, clothing, housing, and shelter and health care or any of that stuff, because, you know, it was always put out there like it was someone else. It never could happen to you because it's someone else. And that was a tool that was used, racism, to control the masses.
It makes a lot more economic sense to prevent homelessness than to actually have to work once people get homeless, you know, and so it makes economic sense to have living wage jobs in a city. We don't have like specific like plan, because what we know is that we're not going to know what's going to work yet, you know. This is still in the beginnings of the movement. Like, we're out to change like who the policymakers are. We're out to connect with enough people so that the people who are making the policies are those affected by the policies, you know. And we're still small. Like, that's the reason that we're reaching out to these other groups across the country and across the world, because we know that any plan that's going to be developed, a lot of people are going to have to like put their heads together to come up with what's really going to solve poverty. And the only way that that's actually going to happen is that the people like most affected by that movement have to be in the leadership positions.
When you talk about using technology and resources to where we are today, right now in the United States, it's going to take people to be a part of this movement that know about technology and how it could be used to make sure food is provided for each and every household at its basic level, and to make sure that we have different people who are that have gone in the fields to be like doctors that figure out like different ways where they can administer medicine and help to different people at a way that everybody can get it. It's going to be difficult for me, you know, who's not a doctor, to tell how all doctors can give everybody health care. That's why, like, we don't have the plan, because we have to do the organizing and changing of the hearts and minds of the people, the masses of the people in the country. So, in turn, you know, where you at with the skills and the level of intelligence that you have, we're going to use all that to come together like this, you know, like the melting pot that, you know, this country is supposed to be. You know, we're going to come together that way and then sit down and beat out a plan, you know, with economists, with accountants, with farms, you know, I mean, farmers, with, you know, you name it. We're going to, once we change the hearts, we'll make sure we can start building policies and stuff like this, so that generations or two later, it doesn't in turn, you know, we repeat the same problem again. So that's like the stage that we're at now. It's not so embryonic, but it's not like nowhere near fully developed. I definitely see the change, you know, and I'm hoping, you know, I'm alive to see it.